Welcome everyone to this talk. As we get towards the end of the event, my talks become less well prepared, or even less well prepared than the ones at the beginning of the conference. Not sure whether we fill the entire slot, but we'll see. So the topic is XDP, AFXDP, and eBPF. I didn't manage to disable the all caps thing in the style sheets of Reveal.js. That's why the E is uppercase, but of course the eBPF in E is actually written lowercase. So we have three different topics in this talk. One is XDP, the Express Data Path, which is not to be confused with AFXDP, which is an address family that you can use in combination with Express Data Path. And then also we have eBPF in the picture, the Evolved Berkeley Packet Filter in there. So this is rather a basic introduction to those features, assuming that most people are not really familiar with it. I'm also not an expert in those topics. I did not participate in the development. I just follow it from afar, given my historic association with the kernel networking. So if we look at the classic network stack and sockets, so let's say, like usually as we do in any kind of telecommunications, we communicate some network traffic with some remote implementation somewhere else. We use sockets, we start a user space program, and we create a socket and we receive and transmit data. That's the classic way of doing things. And this is actually a rather complex part of the software that is sort of between the network card and our socket. So what happens, the kernel receives the packet from a network interface card that usually involves some interrupts and some DMA descriptors and stuff like that. Then the kernel processes the packet layer by layer, first looking at the Ethernet header, discovering that it's a unicast packet for its destination, for its own MAC address, and it passes it to the IP protocol stack because the Ethernet header says it's an IP protocol, and then it processes the IP protocol and determines whether the checksum is correct and whether the destination address is a local address. And if it's a local address, it routes it to the local IP stack, where then you have all kinds of other systems, like is it a tunneled packet, is there some IPsec policy applying to it, is there some inbound traffic shaping, are there packet filter rules, are there network address translation rules, and so on. And at some point it goes into the TCP or UDP or SCTP stack, where then there's additional processing and lookup of the socket table, which socket actually receives the packet. And then once the socket is there, then the question is which process or processes have that file descriptor open, which contain the socket. And then finally, it can basically say, well, this socket is readable and some data has arrived. So it's a rather lengthy process. And the use space process gets woken up, and it goes into its select or poll loop, as we heard in the talk about IOU ring. And then it needs to figure out which of the file descriptors are associated with that socket, and it needs to issue a system call to read the data from that socket, which then goes back into the kernel. The kernel then copies the data from kernel memory to user space memory, and it goes back into the user space process, and finally we can read the packet. So I guess the point is clear. There's a lot of stuff that's happening. Which is all fine, back in the day when I started to do IP in the early mid-90s with modem speeds and 10 megabit Ethernet and E1 lines and frame relay or something like that. And it, of course, computers have become faster over time. And you can say, well, this works fine to gigabit Ethernet. Even that sometimes with a question mark, it depends on the packet size, because all of this processing, of course, happens for each packet. So the throughput is not really relevant, but the numbers of packet per second. So to give you some rough numbers, 100 megabit is 100, the smallest packet size, 100 megabit is 149,000 packets per second. Gigabit is already 1.49 million per second at the smallest possible packet size. That's sort of a DOS scenario, or if you only have TCPX or something like that. So the amount of software processing per packet is high. You need to touch lots of different subsystems, which means there's a lot of stuff that's not in cache necessarily, which means you need to wait for the ultra-slow memory that we have, even if it's DDR5 memory compared to the CPU speeds. I haven't really looked at this in quite some time, but I think already 15 or 20 years ago, you could easily wait 3,000 or more CPU cycles for some data to arrive from RAM, right? So that's sort of just to give you an order of magnitude. And I think there were some comparisons that sometimes were made in talks. It's like, okay, if you get it from level one cache, it's like, okay, I have a fridge next to my desk and I get the Coke from there. And if I get it from a higher level cache, then maybe I walk to the fridge and get it from there. And when I hit the point where I need to hit RAM, it means I have to walk to the supermarket to get the data. So there's really a lot of time the CPU needs to wait if you ever need to get something from RAM. So lots of different pieces of code means lots of different, well, the code might not be in cache, and the data for sure, the state tables and everything it has to look up may not be in cache again, and so on and so on. So a lot of stuff that needs to be done. And then we have the system call boundary, which is very expensive, which brought us to IOU ring in the earlier talk. So again, when the scheduler schedules other processes, of course, also means that a lot of cache gets invalidated and gets populated with other things. So you again lose the cache locality where you're processing. So there are, it's a bit, how can I say, provocative to say so-called solutions like DPDK, which everybody in a certain industry looked as it's really the holy grail of doing things. It's a weird idea where you basically say, well, I'm removing entire network interface cards from Linux, and I'm running other code that is not Linux, and I memory map all those DMA packet buffers from the network interface card into my user space process, and I do all the network processing in there, which, okay, you can do that, but then it means you can achieve quite a bit of performance with that, there's no doubt about it, but, well, you're not writing Linux programs, you're not using POSIX interfaces, and you're not using, actually, and you're not able to use anymore any of the existing Linux kernel network features, right? Because you're not using the kernel network stack, you cannot use TC, you cannot use a kernel IPsec, you cannot use a NetFilter, you cannot use connection tracking net, whatever, because you're bypassing all of that. And it's not possible also to say, well, basically, okay, some traffic I want to have accelerated or some other traffic I want to handle through the normal kernel networking stack because, well, the entire network interface is gone from Linux. So you basically have to solve the problem at a higher level at some router or some switch or something in front of the machine to differentiate it into different network interface, basically network links, VLANs, whatever, or physical network interfaces, and some of them end up in Linux and some of them end up in your DPDK, which, well, yeah, doesn't really, I mean, you don't really, yeah, it's nothing related to Linux there. So this was, of course, I mean, this has happened quite a long time ago. I don't really know. I would guess 10 plus years from now. It was not welcomed very well by the kernel networking community, of course, because it creates this sort of very strange user experience and bypasses everything. So some people thought about what to do this in a way where you do not lose all of that functionality and which is more in line in how we do things in the kernel and how Linux kernel networking guys think the world should look like. So the result of that was the XDP, the Express Data Path, was introduced in Linux 4.18, so you can see it's already quite old from today's perspective. And the idea is that you have some hooks very early in the kernel packet processing, just after the network interface card has received a packet. And you can attach small programs to those hooks, which then decide what should be done with the packet. So, for example, you can do some basic matching, and then you can drop the packet to do some kind of DOS filtering when you know that some certain packets in a certain way, somebody is sending me lots of them, which is just trying to distract me from my work, and I can drop them very early, so I don't need all the expensive processing through the stack only later on to discover I need to drop them. The other opposite is pass, so you just go through the normal slow path, like usually, or you also have the alternative to transmit it directly on another network or the same network interface card. So you can basically make a very fast software control switch or router or whatever, any type of device that forwards packets from one interface to another, by doing the matching very early and transmitting it, and then again all other traffic you let pass. So you still have the option of doing stuff in the normal kernel stack, but you have some optional fast path that you can register there. To me, actually, this looks a lot like NetFilter, but at a higher, at a different level, right? Because the NetFilter hooks in the kernel do the same thing, but they do it inside the IP stack. And this is just basically the same concept, of course, with many additional features and so on, but the same idea applied to different points. So we do not need to look at this diagram in detail. It doesn't matter if you cannot read anything. All I'm trying to illustrate here, this is from, oh, where did the credits go? They're cut off by, it's on the slide, but they're cut off on the projector, sorry. So it's this by Jan Engelhardt, also on Wikipedia, Creative Commons license diagram, which shows you all, the point of this diagram is all the NetFilter hooks and how they happen in which order and where. And of course, this only covers the NetFilter code, and there's all the other code like IPsec and so on here at XFRM, for example, there, and other bits in normal packet processing as well. But the point is basically XDP is here at the very beginning. So all of that stuff you bypass if in XDP you decide to drop the packet or to do something else with it that bypasses the normal network stack. So it's basically the point of it. You can do something very early, very quickly. Now, that's nice, but I mean, with that by itself, all you can do is decide, well, drop, forward somewhere else, or go the normal network stack. So it's not very flexible yet. Works for a software switch or something, and you can drop line rate packets at probably, I'm not sure, I would guess probably 40 gigabits or something now on a box with this, it's nice. it's the first benchmark that all of the people working on this is show what is the maximum number of packets per second drop rate that you can achieve with it. Yay, I can drop that many packets. So I can just disconnect the Ethernet link and also, you know, but yeah, never mind. The next feature is AFXDP. So it's an AF, as we all know in network programming, is an address family. So we have AF INET, we have AF NetLink, we have AF whatever for different sockets. And AFXDP is basically an XDP type of socket. It operates on raw packets like AF packet. Actually, if we go back to the diagram, we see that's probably, yes, relatively close. AF packet is here, right? So it's first we go to the XDP hook, and then we allocate the socket buffer, the SKB, and then clones of that might go to packet sockets. So we even before packet sockets, but at the same level at the link layer processing. We didn't go through IP yet, so it's raw Ethernet packets. The difference is, compared to AF packet, is that we operate on memory mapped RX and TX rings for zero copy. It's a bit like IOU ring, but not at the socket level, but at the network interface card interrupt receive level, right? So where we really, oh, there's a new packet, and then immediately we can do something there. You can use a single socket for RX and TX, which I think is not possible with AF packet. I don't think I've done a lot of transmit with AF packet, very rarely. That may be wrong, so maybe ignore that. So anyway, the RX and TX descriptors on the ring point to memory that is, and TX can point to the same memory as RX. So what you can do with an AFXDP socket, which is a user space program in the end, right? A user space program runs, it gets some kind of notification that a new packet is in the RX ring. Maybe you don't even read the header, but you could read a header or something in a packet, and then the same memory without copying, pointing to the same memory, you can basically set up a transmit descriptor and send that same packet somewhere else. Without having to copy the data around, neither on the RX nor on the TX. So that gives you the ability to write some user space code that can do relatively fast processing of received packet data, but still after you have the AFXDP hook, so after you decided whether you want to do this for a certain socket or not. I thought I added it to the slide. Maybe I didn't regenerate the slide. One thing to note in AFXDP is maybe it's on a later slide, I mentioned it now anyway before I forget about it, is it operates on socket, oh sorry, no, not socket. It operates on receive queues of the network card. So modern network interface cards don't have a single receive queue where all the data comes in, but they have many different receive queues, which normally are used to distribute flows of network traffic on different CPU cores. Right? If you have 32 CPU cores, you don't want to route one interrupt to one CPU and receive all the network packets there. You want to distribute it, and you want to distribute it ideally in an intelligent way that all the packets belonging to one connection end up on the same CPU, so you get the cache locality of the whatever lookup that relates to this particular flow of traffic with a certain hashing on IP addresses or header fields or something like that. And so the AFXDP socket does not work on the entire NIC, but it works on one queue of a NIC. And you need to make sure that the packets you want to receive there actually arrive in this queue number to which you're binding. And there is the normal Linux user land tools like ETH tool and so on, which you can use to configure this the mapping of what traffic ends up in which queue in your network interface card. That's driver dependent, that you need to make sure that basically what you want to receive in your socket goes to the queue that you're binding to. Or you need to bind to multiple queues, of course. Yeah, so how do we write that small program for decision making? Like in a traditional world, writing stuff in the kernel would have meant we need to write a kernel module that we can then register to this hook at AFXDP, sorry, at the XDP hook, not AF, right? So the XDP hook to sort of decide what to do with the packet and how to process it. And these days, the kernel has, for better or for worse, the eBPF virtual machines. This means we can do this without having to write kernel modules. So we can just write some kind of code in whatever language that we want, compile that into eBPF instruction set, and load that at runtime in the kernel and to be executed at this XDP hook in the network stack. And that's how we do the decision making, by attaching a BPF module to the hook. BPF, program is the word, not module, to the hook. So a little bit about eBPF, for those who haven't really looked at it yet. So what we always had in the kernel ever since, I mean, not sure, but I would say at least since the mid-90s is a BPF pocket set. BPF packet filtering. So as a socket filter, that's something that the BPF means Berkeley packet filter, so it originates from the BSD sphere and the BSD network stack. I suppose it was implemented there for the first time. And it's something that every time you use TCP dump, you're using BPF. And even back in the 90s, you would be using BPF, classic traditional BPF. So what this means is when TCP dump, for example, you give a filter expression like whatever, TCP port 80 or something like this, it's actually not something that you tell the TCP dump program, but it's something that the TCP dump program takes and builds instructions for the BPF virtual machine and sends to the kernel in a socket so that inside the kernel the filtering can happen on the TCP port 80 as a socket filter before the data arrives to TCP dump. So the filtering doesn't arrive after TCP dump has received a packet, but it happens inside the kernel socket code before it actually ever sends something to the TCP dump program. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to achieve the kind of performance from TCP dump the filtering performance and so on that you see. So that is traditional BPF. And it, now, of course, this idea of having some kind of virtual machine versus limited instruction set is not really specifically tied to network. eBPF is now the evolved version of BPF. Has many more features, and also the eBPF is not just a virtual machine, but it's also there's a just-in-time compiler. So actually, you write some code either by handwritten assembly or with some compiler or whatever, like any kind of program. You compile it, you end up with instructions for this virtual machine, for this virtual instruction set of the eBPF. That gets loaded into the kernel, and then in the kernel there is a just-in-time compiler that compiles it to x86-64 or whatever your native architecture is, just like a JavaScript JIT or something like that would do in the browser. That makes it relatively fast, given that it's a virtual machine. Of course, it's not as usual, it's not as fast as native code. This instruction set architecture is now actually currently being standardized inside the IETF, so there will be an RFC to actually specify this instruction set. Now, eBPF has all kinds of different program types. I don't think I have stuff more here. So maybe without leaving that slide, there's a lot of things that BPF does. I don't have a clue about how they do it and so on. I just know they claim it, and many smart people have been working on verifying that, in a sense that there is guarantees that you don't have unbound loops and stuff like that. So it's basically, according to the eBPF architecture, apparently it is impossible to have something like an infinite loop or something like that that doesn't terminate. I think initially there was no loops at all in classic Berkeley packet filter, and now they have some very smart stuff where even in the kernel the code gets the object code that you send into the kernel, there's a verifier that does all kinds of checking to make sure that that code cannot access, I think the runtime makes sure you cannot access memory that is not explicitly supposed to access, but also, as I said, in terms of loop and other things, it's basically safe and you cannot introduce the stuff that crashes the kernel this way. But yeah, as I said, I have no idea about how true or not true those claims are, how many problems happened. Just saying this is the marketing pitch of eBPF. Now, eBPF code, XDP is only one use case. This decision making, but that's the one that we are looking at here. There's other use cases, as we have seen, socket filtering, so the classic TCP dunk socket filtering you can also do, and there's many other parts in the kernel today. I guess there's almost no part that you cannot somehow attach BPF programs to. For me, as a old school kernel hacker, that's sort of a bit weird. I'm not entirely sure whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but it is there. So this talk is not about, emotional feelings about new things, but it's about what you can do with it. And you can attach that also to traffic shaping in the kernel. There's lots of performance events. There's kprobe and other things. And you can also use it for tracing. So you can set trace points and say, well, at a certain function entry or system call entry or whatever, I want to execute this eBPF program to do something and then continue. So you can really dynamically do a lot of things that used to be hard-coded, which has positive and negative use cases, of course. What's maybe interesting in our context also is you have the concept of so-called TCP stream parsers that you can implement as eBPF programs and attach to the TCP sockets. So I could actually push the IPA multiplex into an eBPF program inside the kernel to make sure that we always only receive fully, parse the IP header, look at the length, and keep everything in the kernel until we have received a full IPA message, and then only send that over the socket, or even maybe over different sockets, or God knows what. So you can this kind of processing in the kernel, and this also is what used kernel-assisted TLS parsing also works that way, allegedly. I haven't looked at it, but documentation says that. And we have the KCM, the kernel connection machine, which is what we would use for the IPA multiplex if we ever wanted to do this. Chances are very high. Just run BPF tool proc on your system if you're interested. Or install BPF tool, and in my laptop there's 23 programs running, and I'm not, this is just a standard Debian, so BPF is running already in many different tapes. Okay, so one thing still that goes beyond the virtual machine of eBPF is there are some data types and some way how to communicate things between an eBPF program in the kernel and a user space program outside. And this is what's called eBPF maps, which you can think of like some kind of dictionary or whatever, some kind of, let's say, Python dict or something that between the kernel and user space, key value store. And you can use this both ways. So you can add entries and remove them in both ways. And there's all kinds of different types of it for hashes, arrays, radix trees, Bloom filters, and so on. Also per CPU variants. So you can, whatever, you can create a dict or a type key value store where the key is whatever an IP address and the value is a per CPU array of counters, and the kernel code can then efficiently increment those counters because every CPU has its own counter, so there's no synchronization required, and only when you read it they get all summed up and dumped, so you can create efficient ways of aggregating metrics this way. Now, how do we actually do this in the case of XDP? Well, we write our program that we want to attach to the XDP hook. It could be a C program that is compiled using clang target BPF, which compiles for this instruction set of the virtual machine. Then it gets loaded into the kernel and registered at this XDP hook. And then this program selects where to do and what to do. And any other program can handle the stuff that arrives at the AFXDP socket if you do that. Now let's look at a very simple example program. Let me also use this unsigned pointer. So with this SEC here, we say this is an XDP type program. The string basically identifies where it should go. And we have a dummy program, and it has the enormous complex functionality of returning XDP pass, which basically says, well, do as before, as you were. We can also specify the license there of the BPF program. So that's sort of the smallest possible XDP program. And you will, if you load that, how do you test that it works? Well, everything still works. So if you do that with XDP drop, then you will feel more of a difference compared to loading that program. So if we look at a little bit more complex example program here, actually, I think I don't think I can. Okay. No, I get very large buttons at the bottom. I actually already increased the font size in the style sheet, but sorry. But I wanted to scroll.
I can more or less read it, but.
Yeah. So we have a bit more complex. Well, we define some maps here. These are basically the maps. We have per CPU array and whatever an XSK map is. We have the XDP socket map. So, and here we have the program, which basically, well, you see what you get passed into the program is an XDP MD that is metadata, so a structure that describes the metadata of the packet, so what's not in the packet itself, but some metadata. We see in the context, for example, if the RxQ index in which queue it was received, then we basically obtain the packet count from the map indexed by the queue index. And if the packet count is there, if there is a packet count at all, then we perform this function. So basically, the purpose of this is every other packet should pass, and only every second packet gets processed normally, and every other second packet gets processed like is described below here. So. And the code here is actually what you would use to direct it to a user land. So we don't need to go into details. I just want to show you one brief example of something that's not just returning a single value. And this doesn't work on the packet payload at all. It just uses metadata of the packet. But yes, equally, you could, of course, use the packet payload itself and look at headers and do things like that. So yeah, what kind of use cases do we have? Well, actually, people have used this to implement a device driver for DPDK. So you can use DPDK without losing the entire network interface card to the kernel. So progress. Also, VPP is another framework in that area. There is a production-grade DNS load balancer from Power DNS guys called DNS Dist, which uses this for. And I think there's several root DNS servers where actually a load balancer, this load balancer with XDP is implemented in the network. Open vSwitch has, I don't know why it's still experimental, but according to documentation, it's still marked experimental, has support for this. So soft switches, of course, are a very good use case for this. DOS protection filters, intrusion detection systems, Suricata has support for this. And in our context, more relevant, and we will have a talk about this later today, is eUPF and eBPF plus AFXTP accelerated UPF. And I think it's exactly like this entire framework is made exactly for something like a UPF. That was sort of what I wanted to present as an overview of what this is and how it works together. There's a couple of pointers. There's this tutorial which has lots of examples. There's a lot of documentation and blog posts and whatnot. So a lot of things about all of this. Do we have questions, comments? Please wait for the microphone, as usual.
So at some point you mentioned like some ring buffers, and then I mentioned a bit like how to use it on user space, like receiving packets. But yeah, it was not really clear to me. Like, I mean, you just use like the usual socket interface, like BSD socket interface. You have receive, right? But then, do you have something more like?
No, you don't use. So you don't use the normal receive in this case. So it's. There are other AF packet already has memory map features to link even way before. But as soon as you start to have memory map packets, of course, it's not a normal receive or a send or a write call anymore, because that would involve copying data to a user space buffer. So you have some other signaling. I don't recall now. Of
okay. Yeah. That was the. Yeah. Okay. Fine.
But that's only if you actually move data to user space. So, right? I guess the goal really is to keep things in kernel as much as possible inside a BPF program if it's trivial enough to be run there. And only the slow path would go through AFXTP, which is still very fast compared to normal sockets.
But then it's mostly forward stuff. Let's say to all the places.
Like yeah. For that use case. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Niels.
I'm wondering, like, we can tell the kernel to do stuff very quickly, but is there also an official way to get information back into the user land? I'm thinking, of course, of counters and that kind of stuff.
That's where those maps come into place, this eBPF maps. So that's a shared key value store between kernel and user space, and that's exactly this per CPU type. So that is ideal for counters. So in the kernel, we have this concept of underscore per CPU data structures, which means that data structure or that whatever exists once for every CPU, so you can count efficiently in the kernel without blocking or without any kind of synchronization requirement or without cache line ping pong even. And so you have some kernel program does whatever it wants to do, and at some point it increments some per CPU counters in this eBPF map, and then from user space, a user space program can basically also access this map and retrieve the counters. So that would be the classic way, and you can find plenty of examples of doing things like this and that doesn't even need AFXTP, right? That can be done just with XTP, because any eBPF program in the kernel can have those maps shared between kernel user space. So even later, I'm going to talk about BPF trace. That has nothing to do with networking. It's just a tracing framework that also uses eBPF programs. And all the result reporting, I think you also have seen or used even BPF trace in some work before. So you want to count how many syscalls happen somewhere, or how many whatever happens, or how many writes of a certain size happen or something. You can do that, and the reporting is done using, underneath, you're not exposed to all those details, but BPF trace creates BPF programs which use BPF maps to export data to user space.
Just now sharing a moment where I realized, oh, BPF trace, now I get it, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, not sure if you mentioned this yet, but how do you build these programs? So they seem to be standard C programs, but then somehow it gets converted into this bytecode, or?
Well, the example I gave was with the Clang BPF target, right? So you use the Clang compiler, and whatever front end you have for Clang, you can just target the BPF instead of x86 or something like that. But you can do anything. I mean, you can handwrite the assembly if you like. I mean, it's just that this is for a C programmer, that's probably the most convenient way to do it with this target.
XTP can use kernel stack, so it looks good. Yeah, but do you have any idea about the benefit about DPDK? So what is the benefit about the, are you expecting EPP XTP wins the DPDK?
No, I don't think, like, conceptually it cannot, I'm not the expert, right? I'm just following this, but conceptually I think you cannot be faster than what DPDK is doing, as long as DPDK is doing everything right, because as usual, something that is more flexible will always be slower than something that is fixed. Right. So, and DPDK doesn't need to decide whether to process a kernel inside the DPDK program or to feed it in the normal kernel slow path. So you have nothing that needs to take this decision. So you have one decision-making process less. So you have higher performance. So it's to my understanding, AFXDP is the attempt of getting very close to DPDK performance without losing all the normal functionality and flexibility of the Linux kernel. That's sort of the goal, as I understand it. So that many people will say, okay, you know, just an example, making up the number. Okay, so, you know, EPPF is maybe whatever, 5%, 10% slower than DPDK. For this small increase in performance, I'm not going through all the pain of DPDK. And I can just use a standard kernel where I don't need to install custom out-of-tree stuff, and every user needs to install complex things that are not really shipped by a normal Linux distribution, and so on and so on. Right? So that's the difference. So you can say, okay, you know, it's slightly slower, but it just works everywhere.
Another question I had is, like, can we still use like a TCP dump when we are using like the eBPF?
No. So if we look at the diagram, where was it? The large. There we go. The XTP eBPF program executes here. And here you take that decision. And if you already decide to pass it to user space, this happens here. Or if you transmit it to another network interface card, that happens here, right? And the AF packet is the infrastructure that TCP dump uses. And we are not hitting this point anymore. So only if the XTP program says, yes, let it pass to the normal kernel stack, then we allocate the socket buffer and we go to the AF packet socket, which ends up in TCP dump. But if we have here, then we're not. But there is example code how you can generate PCAP through AFXTP sockets. So the program that you can write here could include functionality to also, for debugging purposes, generate PCAP packets. Which are then, I guess, sent over BPF maps, but I'm not sure how exactly they're doing it. But I saw examples for this.
How does priority, like, because if you have several BPF programs running there, or XTP sockets or whatever, like, yeah, how do you know which one is actually executed before the other one? Or
I think you can only attach one BPF program to each queue of your NIC. So if your network interface card has, I don't know, 32 queues, you steer your traffic based on whatever mechanism you have in there, and then you can attach one XTP program to each of those queues, and you cannot have multiple. If you need multiple features, then somehow you need to, I guess, manage this in your XTP program yourself, so you dispatch it to different functions or something like that.
Okay, so that may actually be a problem in the future if more and more programs start using this, I guess.
Possibly, yeah, but it's not really something I've looked into, so.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe a stupid question. I'm wondering, like, we can clearly see where XDP is, and but where's the, you know, the stuff I'm doing with NF tables, where does that happen? The entire colored square, or is it some individual points?
Pre-routing, input, output, post-routing.
So net filters spread about all over the place, but it's bypassed completely by XDP.
Yeah. Yes, yes. So each of those boxes where you see the white at the bottom and the colored at the top, that's a net filter hook with a certain chain. So you actually, maybe you cannot read it here, but because it's too small, but invite you to look at the original diagram on a larger screen or zoom in. So for example, this is the input mangle, input net, input filter. Then the socket lookup, then the local process here. So this is your normal IP, UDP, whatever, TCP socket up here. And if you look at the packet, normal packet processing, ignoring XDP, it arrives here. Then if it's not bridging, then we go in here. We have raw pre-routing, connection tracking, mangle pre-routing, net pre-routing, the normal routing code, mangle input, net input, filter input, socket lookup, local process. And all the normal code happens in between at different stages. So these are just the net filter hooks. Yeah.
I find it really useful to always have these open when I'm doing stuff in net filter.
Yeah.
One more question about the comparison with the tuned device. So if Open5JS UPF is implemented with XDP, does it need to maintain tune UPF or just remove it? Yeah.
Well, maybe we do this in the EUPF talk. We will have a talk also about some EUPF topic later, I think some hours, then maybe we talk about it then, because there's more context then. Yeah. Rock, yeah, maybe, and then I think we should, I'm not sure, since I'm talking myself, how are we in terms of time?
Yeah, okay. just one question. Is it the only place? Is it the only place where you can have the XDP kind of detection point, or you can put it somewhere else? Like if I want to only look at GDPU packets, can I do it a little bit up in the network layer so that I don't have to re-implement the old parsing?
No. I think it's just only one point where you can do the XDP, and that is exactly there. So, yeah. Okay, then thanks again. Let me somehow my printed schedule, I think, is outdated, and let me double check what's on the schedule now. No, actually, okay, back to back, the second talk.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure, okay.
You said the eBPF VM runs on kernel, right? Kernel side.
Yes.
And this code that you compile, is there a instruction set specification for this VM? How does it look like? Which kind of instructions are there?
I cannot tell you. I didn't look at it in this detail. So, but it's all documented out there. And as I said, this instruction set, now there's an IETF working group to turn it into an RFC. So that will be a more formal specification. But it, already there is a spec for this.
And you have stuff like bitwise instructions, like to really parse the message, or something more high level? I mean,
no, it's a normal VM. It's not really specific to message parsing. It's just that, you know, particularly with jumping and backward jumping and so on, there's some restrictions as far as I know. But I'm not an expert on the EPPF VM.
Is it still
recorded? No. Okay.
At LLVM
support,
so you can compile code, you can decompile code, assembly.
I can keep it.
This the same one you're using like for DMA buffer, like for video cameras and this kind of stuff?
I don't know, to be honest, I didn't.
Yeah, because it now rings a bell, like video for Linux and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah. So,
but then you need to see the structure as well as the
So, well, since we just started with BPF, the next BPF-related topic, I didn't remember I put it back to back, but and I remember that I put the one of this one after the previous one, of course. But yeah, so maybe as a quick poll, who has used BPF trace before in this room? Okay, yeah, some, okay. Yeah, so once again, I'm not an expert really. This is all very introductory for this kind of tool. Just wanted to share a bit of my experience, which sadly already is mostly at least 1 year ago. I think I didn't use it much during the last year or so, so it might be rusty at times, my memory. Yeah, if you've used it already, this is like unlikely very interesting to you. But yeah, let's see. So what is BPF trace? It's a high-level tracing language and a runtime. So we have two parts, the runtime actually and the language itself. It's based on eBPF, hence the name BPF trace, as we just Niels has just reminded us about. Yeah, so it does static and dynamic tracing, and it, you can trace stuff both in kernel and user space. It's extremely powerful to do all kinds of things. I probably have not scratched more than 1% of it so far. So just to make sure what we are talking about here, what is tracing in this context is basically, I would define it, this is not a formal definition, but based on my understanding in this context, basically you could say it's the ability to interrupt the flow of a running program at configurable locations in the code. There's several different mechanisms how you basically sort of define the location where you actually want to do something, like at which point in time, at which part of the code. Then you execute some code, you trace code to obtain some data. So for example, how large are the writes that I'm writing or something, or what was the time at this event or something like this. The code that you execute once you've reached that point where you want to do something, that again is using eBPF, since we already have eBPF in the kernel, we can attach BPF programs to all those locations, to those trace points. And the point of all of this is to increase the visibility of what's happening and when, and to aggregate some data before we pass it to user space. Because a lot, of course, if we insert some additional code to generate some traces, that of course will affect the performance of our system. So we have a sort of Heisenberg situation. The closer we look at something, the more tracing we do, the more we affect the timing of the system, and the less realistic it is what we are looking at. And so we want to sort of keep the fast path or the hot path very small and extract only the relevant information, so that copying and passing all that information to user space doesn't impose even more of a burden on the interface. So spontaneous opinion would be sort of the opposite of perf, right? With perf, you sample all the data you can get, and you sample it, and then you have this massive amount of data, and you sort of process it. And here, it's really at the time when something happens, you already extract whatever is relevant to you at that point, and then you pass it on further. So it's a bit different. I mean, not saying it's better, it's just a different approach for different problems. So what is static tracing? Static tracing means in the code you already have hard-coded instrumentation points which were explicitly created by the author of the trace software. We already have some, very few of those in LibOSMO Core. I will show you. I introduced them years ago when debugging some problem. You could say those are part of the stable API, and you can document them and so on. And anyone who wants to analyze something can then use them. And you can, of course, define what kind of data is available at this trace point and so on. And that can be done relatively efficient. I'm not sure how it's implemented in detail. I know some other mechanisms like this, maybe not necessarily this one. They work by having like knobs in the object code, and then you insert an instruction. When you activate the trace point, you replace the knobs with a jump to some code. When you remove the trace point, you put the knobs in again in the executable code, so you you basically don't lose anything other than a couple of bytes of executable file size. So the overhead of introducing this in the code is low, and therefore it's you can do that. So dynamic tracing is different. Basically, you do this at unforeseen points. So the software developer of the program didn't put some explicit hook in somewhere for tracing, but you do it more like, think of it like you put a watch point or a breakpoint or something somewhere, and then you do something somewhere in a program, like you could do with GDB. That's more a dynamic tracing approach. And that obviously needs a symbol table, whereas the previous one doesn't, because that trace point itself is explicitly defined by the author in static tracing, but dynamic tracing you just do somewhere. So we have something called probe providers in BPF trace. And then each probe provider provides probe points. And then at the probe point, you can execute some code. And there's some probe providers which are sort of really, they're not really, they just put it in there, but it's not really what you would expect. So begin and end, so basically you can write some code that gets executed when you start the BPF trace program and when you terminate it. So like initialize some data structures or compute some aggregate values at axis, something like this. They're just implemented the same way. So basically when you write a BPF program, it's like not like writing a C program with a single main function, but you sort of write a program that has many different entry points, and one of them is the begin, which would be like your main in C, and the end is sort of something else that you call it the end, and then you have all kinds of other potential functions that you can register or hook into, which are provided by different probe providers. So we have hardware probe provider. These are processor level events. There is interval, which is code that gets periodically called. So if you want to do some statistics over time, then you can say, well, at an interval of I don't know how many milliseconds, something should happen, for example. Then we have K probe and K red probe. That's a generic mechanism in the kernel for tracing kernel function entry and exit. So red probe return probing and K probe at the beginning of the function. Profiling is, what you know, I guess I don't need to go into that. Then we have software events, trace points, and so on. And there's also the equivalent of K-probe is U-probe and U-red-probe for user-level function trace points. So each of those provide a lot of different trace points. If you want to look at the available probes, you can do BPF trace minus L, and I'm just doing a line count, and it's 153,000 different probe points that my laptop here has. And that, of course, excludes any additional probe points that the library or program that I actually may want to trace in user space might in addition provide to that. So that's just what I have out of the box from the kernel, basically. And I can attach stuff to that. So yeah, as I said, we define small functions and we define when they get executed. So this has larger font size, yeah. So I changed this. I didn't regenerate the slides, the other one. So this is the most basic example, one of the most basic examples you can do, right? We basically say we want to register to something the trace point probe provider provides, and to a syscall, and specifically to sysenter openAT. So this is a trace point provided in the kernel whenever the openAT system call is entered. And then we print a format string where we print the com and the args.filename. So to know that in context, you need to know that in modern systems, all open functions that you make use the openAT system call. So anytime you open a file, it goes through that call. And com now is a variable that in BPF trace programs is a built-in variable that has the current process name. So basically the first argument of a printf will be the program name, and the second argument is the file name of what you're opening. And this args is another built-in, you could say, variable of BPF trace. It is a structure that contains all the arguments of the trace point. And if you want to look at what kind of structures are available at a given trace point, you can use this command, the minus VL, for a given trace point, and if you do that, then it will tell you sort of what we can do that later. Look at what kind of, like here, for example, the file name member of the structure, it will tell you that this exists. And the str function is another built-in function to convert that into a string, because from that structure it might not be clear that it's a string type. So it looks almost like C, you know, if you look at this printf and format string and so on. So the language that you write in BPS phrase is close to C, but only superficially. Yeah, so how do we execute a program? Well, we can just call it BPF tries minus E and then put in quotes the entire program. I mean, this scrolls way beyond the slide because it's I don't want to scroll now. But it's basically the entire example here put in one line and passing that to the trace point, to the BPF trace program as an argument. So let me actually try to do that. No. Let's do it like this. So we copy and paste this entire thing. I'm not sure if it copies everything. We'll see. Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course, I need to do sudo. Yeah, and you can see that any program that opens any file, after you start the program, you get these lines printed. So the UPowerD was doing some whatever ACPI device. Then here we have the Think Fan Daemon that opens the hardware monitor temperature input to regulate the fans on the system. So this becomes immediately active on a system level. So any open by any process gets executed, the code that you specify gets executed. That may not always be what you want. So there's a capability to filter, but let's just do this example here as well, this VL, so we get this description of the structure. Yeah, again. So we see that the enter open AT trace point has an integer system call number, then the DFD, probably file descriptor, I'm not sure, then we have the file name, flags, and the mode. So basically, whatever kind of metadata is available at the time you open a file, that gets passed in this struct, and this is the args that you get and that you can use in the program there. Now, the other option is you put your program in a text file for more complex program. That's of course the normal part. You just put in a text file and you execute BPF trace, giving that as an argument the file. You can also do shebang kind of script execution style, like a bash script, so you can put the first line BPF trace and then execute that script this way. So another nice feature is the built-in histograms. So this is a BPF trace example where we say basically, well, we want to trace the system call sysexit, we read. So when we leave the read call, when the read call completes, and then we have this new part that we didn't see in the previous example. This is between the slashes is a filter expression. So we don't get this for every read on a system, but only for reads of this specific process ID. So PID, again, is a built-in variable. You could also do it this with com, the program name. So I have some other examples where I put osmo slash as a prefix match, so only all the osmocom programs that are running, all processes that have osmo dash in the beginning are the ones that I want to look at. And what I'm doing then here is this at bytes is basically I'm defining a new dict here, and it's a histogram type of the return value of the arguments a part of the read exit. So what I'm getting then, and attach the probe, and when it doesn't do anything, I don't see any output because there's no print statement in there. But when I terminate the program with Control C, I will get the ASCII histogram representation. And this basically tells me, well, between the time of attaching the probe and pressing Control C, I'm getting, there were reads of 0 or 1, there were 12 reads of 0 or 1 bytes, and there were 19 reads between 64 and 128 bytes. So that's what I'm getting there. And that's rather nice to analyze stuff with system calls, with these syscall entry, syscall exit. You can look at what's happening and what sizes and so on. And this very powerful, this built-in histogram. So this is another example from an from a BPF example. Yeah, unfortunately, the line wrapping somehow didn't work when I changed the font size of the slide thingy. But yeah, it's timing the read. So here we actually built another dict or map or whatever you want to call it, indexed by the TID. That's probably the thread ID in this context. We at the end at the read enter the VFS read execution, we put the nsex is the number of nanoseconds. It's an automatic built-in timer variable of BPF trace. So we put in this map indexed by the thread ID, we put the nanoseconds, and then we have a kret probe with VFS read where we then subtract. I can show you the example, but basically the point is we want to compute the time that a read is taking. And this is now the amount of nanoseconds that were spent for a read call. We again get the histogram of something like this. So we can basically see how long did a certain function call or a certain system call or something like this take. Now, some Osmocom examples. This was for counting polls. So I say, well, the sysenter poll trace point, and if, well, actually I'm doing this here, yeah, because prefix match is not available as a filter expression, so I have to do it in explicit code. Well, if the beginning of my program name is Osmo, then I have the polls total dict for the given process, for let's say the Osmo BTS, Osmo BSC, something like that. I increment that. And if the timeout is zero, then I have a second one to increment that. So basically the point of this is to get an idea of how many poll calls have a zero timeout for each of the programs that I'm executing. And I get separate counts on, this is an interval here, so every 100 millisecond, it will print those four print those two and clear them again. So every 100 milliseconds, I'm getting an output that tells me how many poll calls of my Osmocom programs had a zero timeout and how many poll calls were there in total. At that time, we were trying to find out why on earth a poll was called with a zero timeout, because sort of if you know that, why are you calling poll if you're immediately returning? There was a second example, but it's copy and paste. I didn't reload maybe here in the browser. Yeah, okay, it was just the browser reload that was missing. So the second slide, again, where we only want to look at Osmo BSC, the number of polls total, number zero, and we print this way. So this was just for Osmo BSC. You can use that filter expression. But if you want all the Osmocom, like prefix matching or something, I don't think you can put it in the filter expression. It's not that meaningful, so you need to do like an explicit string number compare at the beginning to do that. We had this, we still have actually, the Osmo MSC SQLite issue that I gave up on or didn't find time anymore to complete 2 years ago. This issue has a lot of examples where BPF trace was used, and this is one that I like particularly. Is sort of we do a U probe in the libdbi for the query f functions, and then we create a map or dict or whatever you want to call it with the query string, and we count the number of executions. So you actually get output like this, where you say, well, this query, the count of the number of this query was 7. So you see which SQL statements are executed how often while you were tracing. So you get an idea like which of the SQL statements are executed more frequently than others, things like that. So in terms of the static, I forgot the F11 after the shell, sorry. static user space trace points in libOSMO core. This was what I introduced when we were looking at logging performance, and we figured out that in the end, by this kind of help and many other bits, that our standard output standard error was still blocking at that time. So logging to a file or logging to syslog or anything like this was fine, but as soon as you still had some log output to standard error output, this would actually be blocking writes, which could delay the process. And so in order to debug this, I introduced the log start and log done probe points in libOSMO core. There's a file called probes.d where you define the probes that you have. And this file, there's some autoconf voodoo that generates a header file from this. And the code that was manually added in the logging.c file is basically just a couple of trace defines where we, if system tap is enabled, that's basically this USDT stuff, then we include the probes.h file and those trace macros do something, and if not, they don't. And in order to enable this, you have to use the dash dash, did I have it here? I don't have it here. So you need to configure with dash dash enable dash system tap or something, and then those become defined. So in the end, in the code, we put, this is the normal log P2 function of libOSMO core, and this line trace libOSMO core log start and trace libOSMO core log done was the two lines that I had to add to the code. And as I said, those should be fairly low overhead if the trace points are not used, as far as I understand. I didn't investigate this at a low-level detail. And now we can have a libOSMO core program like this, or sorry, a BPF program for libOSMO core like this. We say, well, this beginning is just a hello, what it does. And then we have the USDT for the shared object file of libOSMO core with the log start and the log done. And the log start for a given thread ID, basically PID, but in multi-threaded, it's a per thread ID. We take the nanoseconds at start, and then when the logging is done, we subtract the then nanoseconds from the starting nanoseconds. We divide it by 1,000, so we get microseconds, and we take a histogram of that, and we delete the temporary start timestamp that we created here. And in the end, we just clear everything and we print it. And from that, we get, I don't have the output here, but we get a histogram of how long the various log start, log end calls took, and we see sort of if there are any log statements that take too long. Just a second, I think, yeah, we're already at further reading, so then we can take questions. Please wait for the microphone. Just get something to drink.
So when I used BPF trace, I thought, okay, what do I have to do? How do I have to change my program? And then it turns out I don't even have to restart it or anything. I can just run BPF trace and get hooks into a specific function in my code that I didn't touch in any way. So I'm wondering, how does it do it? How is it possible and still, you know, efficient? I mean, how is it done?
I can't tell you in detail. I didn't implement it. I didn't look at how it's implemented. For the completely dynamic tracing. It's just that the dynamic tracing uses it's efficient, but if many people say it's not efficient, so that's why the static tracing exists. That's why for the logging I introduced the static hooks. So I guess I cannot comment on what the overhead is, but for sure any kind of dynamic tracing always has quite a bit of overhead introduced.
Yeah, I could say something. So I looked into ftrace, which was before BPF came in, and ftrace just added some hooks for every function enter and exit with a knob. And if you activate ftrace, and I think BPF can hook also on all traces, they replace the knob in the kernel space and replace the knob with the jump and jump then back. So if you use tracing, there is an overhead. Otherwise, like you also said, there's a knob.
Yeah, but that can work if you have such a generic framework in the kernel. But for a user space program, your compiler doesn't insert those knobs. So I'm not sure how a dynamic user space tracing, like how it's... It does? Yeah? So. Okay. So yeah, maybe you can answer that, yeah.
The Linux kernel has to know about the local machine code and will then just edit the machine code in RAM while it's executed. For example, replace a jump to a function call with an interrupt, and then, yeah.
Okay, but it's an interrupt or something then, and yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, okay, as I said, I didn't look at the details of the implementation. Yeah, Paul.
I could say I didn't look into it, but I guess it just like replaces some instruction with a jump somewhere else, and I just like it's a trampoline, and then just goes back and continues the execution. So probably it's not efficient because then basically you are jumping to some other memory region. So basically the code cache is just, and on the static one probably just put in place. So yeah, you don't have this problem.
I mean, one of the other advantages of having the static trace points is also that you sort of give the potential user some guideline what would be nice, what would be a good location to trace, right? So the log start, log end, that's very clear, but then like log P2, or they have so many different logging related functions, you have to read all the code to figure out where do I need to dynamically insert the trace point, and if some is predefined, then it's very clear what is a good point to trace this subsystem. Yeah.
Yeah, so that SQLite thing that we were looking at appeared on some hardware and not on others. So, I mean, in the end, we decided to do something else, but we still didn't. So it's still there. So if one did want to look at that, can you also trace maybe like a hard disk hardware controller driver or something? Or how, like all of those 150,000 trace options, is that like a sort of core kernel syscalls, or can you like would a network controller driver also have possibilities to do something when packet is received at that level, or how far down can you go?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why is it? Oh, it just takes so long to. I mean, you can see really it goes. It always depends on the subsystem. So this is AES crypto code in the kernel and so on. You said something about a block device. Let's look for block. I'm not quite sure. Well, you can actually. Yeah, I wouldn't know, like I would have to check what the specific subsystem, what it has. But the problem, of course, yeah, here is the block requests and dirty buffers, block IO start and so on. So you clearly have in a generic block and in file system specific code, butterfs and so on. So there are all kinds of places that you can trace and so on, but you would really have to understand a specific subsystem. And of course, once you leave something that is executed on behalf of a process, it will be difficult to impossible to attribute it to a given process, right? So in the kernel, if you trace it, if you want to trace something that happens in the user space program, sort of at the system call, you still know which program triggered the write. But by the time it has gone through the file system and you end up in the block device layer, you have no clue which program made that write anymore, because it's like seven layers of abstraction across. So yes, you can trace whatever how long probably is how long an IO request took, but yeah, which of those requests it was. Okay, one more.
Yeah, I guess there's also some functionality to print stack traces.
Yes, there is. You can also do backtraces and histograms of backtraces. I did that once. It was sort of not ideal, but I could get some value on it. So basically, you can say, well, take the backtrace of, I don't know, I think with a certain depth, and then you can use that as a key into a histogram. So you can basically say, oh, my function was most often like 300 whatever, 7 times was called through this path, but then sometimes it was called through another call path. So you can do things like this. Yeah, that's true. Okay, good. Then thanks for your attention.